Nation, welcome back to ETPN's NBA Team Podcast. As we're in the Thanksgiving week, doing an early shot here. I had to reconvene for on an early entry here with Mr. Adam Murray, my co-host that I'm going to introduce in a second for different reasons. But I'm going to just go ahead and introduce him now. Adam, how was your Thanksgiving?
It was great. I slept through it. I thought we reconvened because you were up for all the Black Friday sales, and you're just like, I'm up, I'm wired, so.
I am tired. I will say, I might have to throw in my man card. I had to wait in line at Target for a Hatchimal.
That's not throwing in your man card. That's just throwing in your good dad card.
How am I bad? Wait. So you're saying I'm a bad dad?
No, I'm saying you're a good dad. You don't need to throw in your man card for getting...
But if you're throwing in your good dad card, that means you're a bad dad.
No, you're just throwing it into the ring. You're not throwing it out.
No, that's or turning in. I was trying to say turning in.
There's no need to turn it in. I've seen it all. There's nothing wrong with getting a Hatchimal.
Well, you're a father of one, going to be too soon. Give me the most embarrassing thing you've ever had to do as a parent.
Nothing really yet. Nothing.
Like jumping a bounce house or.
No, I haven't done any of that. The worst thing is just being like, you know, pull up your pants when you, you know, coming out of the toilet with his, you know, underwear is hanging down and, you know, just little ticky tacky stuff like that. But I haven't had to.
There's a little backstory for the Hatchimals that, you know, I tried to do it one time and it was 7 o'clock. I totally underestimated the determination of moms for these toys. So I get there, and the tickets are already given out. They're done. It's over. Like, I've already lost. You know? I'm like, what's a good example? I'm like the Memphis Grizzlies. I never had a shot, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm like, I can't be the Memphis Grizzlies of this line. I have to be the Cavaliers. I have to get out front. You know? I've got to take the bull by the horns. I can't believe this. I'm even saying this, you know, on podcast form, but I have to tell the story because I lost so much sleep because of it. I got up and I waited at 4:30 in the morning and I sat there and waited for this thing. But guess what? I was first in line.
There you go. 4:30, that's actually pretty late. I remember, you know, 4:30, the line was already back out the door, and even like Best Buy back in the days out at, you know, 3 hours in advance.
Well, the other hot item that I've known just from being in the periphery of people asking what I'm waiting for and what they're waiting for. The other one is the mobile NES system. Is that it?
Yeah, it's not mobile. It's just the retro.
And it's got like 130 games built into it.
I thought it was just 30, but...
Oh, you might be right. It might be 30.
It's 30, and it's the same.
I was so groggy when they would talk about it, I don't even remember what they said. Because I had no motivation. I would buy it if it was there. It was kind of like, you know, two birds with one stone. But if I don't get it, it's okay. You know, it's not a big deal. It was the Hatchimal that I needed. And you know what this Hatchimal thing is? You literally, like, hatch it over, like, a period of, like, months. Like, you have to, like, rub it, and you have to, like... keep it at room temperature, and it just slowly weeds itself out, changes colors. It's a super complicated toy. I'm like, they put more time into this than I don't think the people that are waiting line even realize.
It's just like isn't it just a Furby in a shell?
Yes, but they got a lot more dimensions to it. It's a little more advanced, kind of like all toys now. It's the same thing, only more advanced. Which is hilarious that the NES is the hottest item because it's like one of the oldest toys ever. It's just a digested version of it.
It's the oldest toy ever. Plus, it's also all the games are already on the Wii and the Wii U, you know, shop. So it's not like it's anything you can't already play. It's just, you know, nostalgia, whatever.
And Black Friday is different now because you got Doorbusters. Doorbusters kind of like alleviated the Black Friday tension. So now whatever deals you could get them online in the afternoon on Thanksgiving after you're done stuffing your face with, you know, cranberry and turkey and all that. And you can just wait. You could do it in the early afternoon instead of having to wait until like 3 o'clock in the morning the Friday after to get stampeded and trampled on by other customers to look for the same thing everybody else is looking for. You know, Black Friday's almost become passe. You get there on Black Friday in the morning and everything's basically gone because of Doorbusters.
Yeah, but I don't know. I'm just one of those people who shops all year round, so I don't really have to scramble.
Yeah. Well, for movies, Like, Doorbusters is my thing. Like, that's when I get the deals. The other one, what's the other one called? Cyber Monday?
Yeah.
That's when you get the deals online. And, you know, to be honest, we got a lot of our deals, like a fryer, a couple, you know, furniture. We got a couple of our deals online before Doorbusters even started. You know, so you know, most of the work was done. But, you know, some people just, they like that. They like the heart racing type
of thrill. It's the experience. Yeah.
Yes. They like being around the crowd. That's why people go to the fair. That's why people go to concerts, you know. That's why people go to most NBA games unless you're a Pelicans fan.
They are on a win streak.
I have to mention a couple of things with the Pelicans, you know, loosely before we kind of actually start talking about real basketball. What do you think of Drew Holiday's goggles? He looks like he's gained a tad bit of weight, or is that muscle?
It looks like a little bit of weight.
Yeah, but his goggles are super efficient. He's shooting 54% so far.
His goggles are bad, but they're not like Aaron Baines bad.
Now Horace rocked the goggles. No one rocked their goggles better than Horace because he had the bald head. The band matched his tone of his head. Like it all kind of fit perfectly. Whereas Drew's look like it's like a dark green goggle like lens. It's just weird, you know. The other one who rocked it great was Antoine Carr.
Yeah.
I don't even think – it was more shades, right? Wasn't it?
I don't know what they were, but it's good to see him back, and it's good to see everything is calmed down in his life.
And here's the thing with the Pelicans too, since I'm glad you talked about them off the top so we can get them out of the way. They're actually beating good teams. It's not like they got into the divot part of their schedule and they were able to scratch out some easy ones or – wins against teams that are not as competitive as, you know, other times of their schedule, kind of like the Atlanta Hawks did in the beginning of their schedule. They actually beat the Blazers. They beat the Hornets. And there was another team. I think they beat the Celtics,
The Celtics, yep.
Yeah. So they – almost all of them were at home except for one. But and the other one is that they blew out, I believe, the Minnesota Timberwolves, who you wanted to talk about in a little bit. But, yeah, just really interesting. Their offense has improved vastly over the last five games. Like they've already gotten themselves back in the top 10 in offense. And you know, just with the, you know, how many games they've won? Four in a row?
Four in a row or four out of five or five in a row. They are on a...
They're not in the bottom. You know, the bottom right now, I believe, is Dallas in the West.
They're in their own little world.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of rumors about them trying to swing a trade. One I heard that was interesting on the Starters, that was just kind of thrown out there. There's no truth to it. There's no substance to it, but it does make sense. Brandon Knight with the Suns. Do you think that's possible going to the Dallas Mavericks?
Yeah, but what would they give up? That's the.
You can trade Barea if you want to. You can maybe trade Darren Williams, but here's the problem: is that the Suns aren't fishing for point guards. So the only other guy the Suns would want is maybe Dwight Powell, but the Mavs really like Dwight Powell. So,
and that's not even equal value. That's just we need to get rid of the logjam.
Yeah, if it turns out to be Justin Anderson, then you got a really tough decision to make because, you know, that's one of your only good young guys on that roster altogether. And, you know, that kind of 3-4 spot, they do need some athleticism there because Marquese Chris, to me, is more of a 4. Would you agree, or have you seen enough of him to kind of figure out what he is?
I don't think he knows what he is yet. He's kind of a 4, but...
He's decent. I've seen him put out some decent, like, spots every now and then as a rookie. Tyler Ulis, I think he got a bit of an injury from the beginning, but he's playing a little bit more time now that Brandon Knight is, like, a de facto six man. You know, it's almost like Ulis is like an insurance policy in case they moved another guard. And TJ Warren is playing a lot, but Warren is not super athletic. He gets to the free throw line and he's a good scorer, but he's not super athletic.
And it's funny, we mentioned many times before, if you forget your history, you're doomed to repeat it. What do we have? We have two point guards who are exactly the same and a third undersized point guard who can easily play, and Phoenix is in the same mess of too many combo guards in the kitchen.
Yeah, the last team right now is Dallas at 2-12. Oh my goodness. Then right below them is actually the Minnesota Timberwolves at 4-10. And I think there was kind of like an overlying point about coaching that you wanted to mention about the NBA in general, kind of a trend that you noticed that was a little bit alarming, and you wanted to use the Timberwolves as an example.
Well, there's I had a point, but I forgot. There's one thing. It's just, you know, the reports are Thibodeau wants a veteran because his team is just too young and too inexperienced and just falls apart.
Why did you cut Kevin Garnett?
They didn't cut him. He's like, I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
He can't give. They need a veteran who can play. They got coaches on the floor. They got Cole Aldrich and somebody, Jordan Hill, who can, you know, a veteran.
Brandon Rush, you know.
Yeah, they got people who've been around, but they want a veteran who can play and can start. But the question is, A, who of the young core do you break up? And B, can you make any trades now with this new money? Or are you stuck because nothing will ever be a fair deal?
Well, here's the thing. There's a big difference between a fair deal and a deal being done. We see a lot of one-sided trades on paper that are purely orchestrated because of either salary dump so that you can get some cap space for the summer, or because a team is trying to push for a playoff run, a la the Cavs getting Channing Frye and having to give up almost nothing to do it. You know, so they sort of have the advantage of being a playoff team and being in the mix, and the non-competitive team sort of gives up that player because the player wants out anyway, and they don't want a malcontent on their team at the end of the season. So there's different reasons and there's different circumstances behind all of the teams and what deals they make. You make a good point about the new money with the increase in salary that we had because of the salary cap quantum leap that we had this past summer. You know, that doesn't even count the money that people had made the summer before. Because you know what's weird about it, Adam, is that we actually have sort of like three phases of new money or three phases of salaries. You have the pre-2015 summer salaries. Then you have the 2015 summer salaries, like, for example, the deal that Tristan Thompson got from the Cavaliers where the cap was rising, but no one knew how high it would go. So it was almost more of an estimation where it was a pretty sizable increase, but it wasn't like what Nicholas Batum got like $25 million a year, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it didn't go that high. Now you got the new money where guys like Nick Batum is getting $25 million. So say, for example, the Hornets are listening to offers for Nick Batum, which is not going to happen. It's just a hypothesis. Well, how are you going to move that around? You know, how are you going to be able to make that work? Because you have people like, say, for example, the Charlotte Hornets want Al-Farouq Aminu. Now, Al-Farouq Aminu signed in the summer of 2015 at, I believe it was $9 million a year, which for him seemed overpriced. Now it's starting to look more like a fair deal. Well, guess what? You got to add somebody else in. Who are you going to add in?
Well, that's the thing. It's how are teams like, let's say, Utah, Minnesota, Boston, Philly. Philly has a ton of cap room, but how can any of these teams make deals where you could basically do Ian Mahimi or like a Jeff Green almost straight up for like a Kevin Love?
Yeah, do you think that was the idea of Jeff Green? The thing that stuns me about Vogel is that he starts him ahead of Aaron Gordon, which seems incredibly counterproductive, but that's a different story for a different day. But do you think a lot of these are just guys that they sign to 1 year deals purely because of the potential of being able to shed him?
That's pure cap fodder. He's not taking up any space on our deal. And you have like, how are the Lakers gonna move Luol Deng? How are they gonna move Mozgov if they want to? You're stuck with this $15 million deal because all you can get is, you know, nobody's gonna trade anything for him, and old money is just you have a superstar, and new money it's just you have a very mediocre player for the same price.
Well, here's a good point. Do you like, because the idea of signing big men is that, well, we will be able to move them because a team will desperately want to get bigger, because as you and I always talk about, playoff games, they slow down. You need size to neutralize. You need defense, and big men are always equated with defense in the playoffs so that you could slow the games down. So you have Mozgov, for example, with the Lakers, but he got signed underneath that, you know, the new cap standards to where he got $16 million a year, which a lot of people unanimously thought was an overpay. But is it possible to still be able to move a contract like Mozgov's to a playoff team who's really desperate? They're not in the tax yet. They're willing to go maybe $5 million over the cap so that they could try to push, so that they could have that extra big man. I mean, the other ones are guards, but guards are sort of getting overpriced in the NBA now too.
Yeah, and like, that's the thing is, what can you move? Like, look at Washington. You have Bradley Beal and John Wall, which, you know,
that team looks like a mess. By the way,
they can't play together. How do you move Bradley Beal and his $24-25 million? You physically can't move that contract for anything.
Because you got to move Gortat, and you have to basically reverse engineer the team.
But if they can't play together, you can't. The thing is, everybody's stuck with these players for 2 years, as you know, it used to be, all right, I signed my superstar, he's not working, oh, let's do a major swap, let's have a four-team trade where a lot of pieces move around. Now you can't have that because you're not going to get any fair value for it, and in order to get somebody, anybody, you're going to have to tear apart your team. It'll have to be like a 5-for-1. You know, here's yes. 3 first-round picks, and here's like 3 or 4 players for one guy who's not even a superstar anymore.
Well, look at Max. I mean, Max is at 5 years for any contract, you know, that you agree to. So, for example, like 2014 was the last year where we really had money that was straddled at a cap that was under 90 million. Or if it was at 90 million, it was barely at 90 million. So say a 5-year deal was signed in 2014, that's a contract that goes all the way to the length of, if I'm doing my numbers right, 2019, correct?
Yep.
So like you're saying with the math that you're talking about with the Wizards is that you might wind up having to agree to a trade where you're shedding valuable contracts and having to give up multiple players on decent salaries. Like so that's, it's like, for example, the Cavs, if they, the Boston Celtics, if they traded Jay Crowder because they felt like they needed to add something, but you give up a very valuable contract.
You trade Jay Crowder, but you can't trade him for anything because he only makes $9 million.
He's a dip in the bucket to the exchange. You're only doing it just.
And that's
to
the thing is you need to have, it needs to be Amir. It needs to be Tyler Zeller. And Crowder, that's $29 million.
Now, but teams are willing to do this. Like the Warriors did it with Bogut, where they gave up an $11 million salary and a big piece of what made their front court work in order to get Durant. You know, but that's – listen, big teams making deals like that are – they're not rare, but they don't happen too often. You know, we just had to – we just saw it with the Spurs in the offseason with – Boris Diaw, and who was the other one that they wound up letting go that was kind of a valuable part of their team? I'm totally blanking on the guy. But they let another guy go so that they can get Pau Gasol because they just did not have room for him otherwise, you know?
Yeah, and they had to pay extra for him because of the new money, and I forget what they gave him, 10 or 15 million?
Give me a potential like trade target under the new type of salary structure starting from the summer 2015. So it would have to be a player that was signed starting in 2015 that you think might be like somebody that people might target. One that I heard right off the bat was Luol Deng with the Lakers. I don't know if that's possible, but
that's what you could get. You know, you can give 2-for-1. You could give an overpriced guy and then like a young piece, but I don't know how valuable Luol Deng is anymore because you watch him, he doesn't really fit in that system. Obviously, I think the most friendly contract right now in all the NBA and doesn't really fit anywhere is Kenneth Faried.
Yes, but here's the funny part about Faried that I've noticed in the stat lines. He's playing a lot more. Do you think there's political reasons for that? Maybe they want to show him out more so that teams are more attracted to wanting to acquire him?
No. What I've noticed is, I don't want to say it's a conspiracy, but all the rookies are all playing like 20 minutes a game. Remember back in the day, it used to be like, oh, you could go out for 48 minutes. We don't care. Go learn. Now you don't see – the only one who I think is getting like 30 minutes is Andrew Harrison in Memphis.
Yeah, and that's strange. That's a very just one of those rare birds with Andrew Harrison, because the other one who's getting a lot of blow is I believe Wade Baldwin the fourth, because they just need a traditional.
Well, because they need a point guard, but even he's down to 20 minutes. You see, Chris Dunn 20 minutes. You see Jaylen Brown 20 minutes. You see Marquise Chris. You said under 20 minutes, like Sabonis and Pascal Siakam in Toronto. They're both starting under 20 minutes. It's like. Everybody's on a strict minute limit all of a sudden.
Did you mention Sabonis with the Thunder already?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. That's one of those they call it the Keith Bogans role. That's what they call it, cuz Keith Bogans did this with the Bulls when they signed him along with Derrick Rose and Joakim Noah and Carlos Boozer, where he would start, but he would barely – he wouldn't play the rest of the game. He was just there to be the starter, you know?
Yeah, it's – but it just seems strange to have every rookie – like, you don't see any – you're like, oh, who's the rookie of the year? We're like – you know, we're still having the debate now. It's like, well, but everybody's getting limited minutes. There's no, like
– But they're not afraid to start him. It's almost like they're trying to get their feet wet, but they don't want to just totally dive into it. You know,
yeah, but
you see the fluctuation with Buddy Hield with my Pelicans. Like they jumped him in pretty fast with a lot of minutes. Then they started railing him back the moment Jrue Holiday came back. You know.
Yeah, now he's down to like 6 minute garbage time, which doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's just. You know, it's just like, it seems like everybody for the next year or two is stuck with who they have. You made your deals, now you have to sit in. You can't trade first round picks. You can, but they're only worth $3 million. So if you're trying to trade for a player who's $20 million, you can only put 3 first round picks, and that's $9 million.
I'll give you just a few names that were signed through the last, you know, at least from 2015 through, you know, the one that's an exception that I do think will be moved eventually, that since we were talking about the Timberwolves to start this whole conversation off, is Ricky Rubio. I think his time is ticking. And now Tom Thibodeau is playing him a ton of minutes when he is healthy, but that's the problem. Rubio's not healthy. The good thing about Rubio's injuries is that it's given Chris Dunn a lot of time to learn at point guard. But we know how Thibodeau is. He's very, very firm. He doesn't always like to trust young guys. Is he going to trust Dunn enough to start that many minutes and let Rubio walk?
Well, that's sort of the only piece he can move is Rubio for. But what can you really get? All you could get is sort of a six man if you're content with...
That's a $14 million contract, I believe, per year?
I think so, but you have Levine Levine. I think he's your starting two. You got Wiggins, your starting three. You got Anthony Towns, who's not moving. You got Gorgui Dieng, who you've just signed to be your center. So how can you really upgrade your starting lineup if you have your pieces in place?
Do you think the Dieng extension, while justified, sort of straddled them a bit? Or do you think that they still have enough cap space going forward to sort of get out of that? Because remember, next summer, Wiggins' max extension's coming. So
yeah, they'll be fine with that because Dieng is his was a, you know, it wasn't – was 64?
Yeah.
It wasn't a terrible deal, so he
it
can
was
be the...
It was almost the same contract Cody Zeller got, you know.
It could be easily moved, and he's the most – you know, he's not a big stiff, so I assume he'd have value. It's just, you know, why would you give him up to, you know, how are you going to get a all-star center for that? And it's just one of those things like, yeah, you want to upgrade your team, but how can you if you have your young pieces? All you could do is sort of blow your team up again, I think by accident, the way sort of Orlando did.
Yes, I mean, I still can't understand what Orlando's doing. Right now they sit at 6-9, which is actually a little more competitive than I expected. But Serge Ibaka is not exactly playing great. You know, he's had 7 rebounds a game, which is good, which is decent, but I've seen him play much better in terms of getting the rebounds. Biombo's playing okay, but he's
Biombo's
not.
Biombo's playing okay. Vucevic is back in form.
Yes. Now, is that a movable deal? Vucevic.
Yeah, but I think he's way too valuable now. He's
valuable to Orlando, but
he's
I
the
mean,
best guy they have, and the Elfrid Payton train is slowly
coming to a stop, or is
it is
derailed?
Yeah, that's the we need to keep him, and that's what got what's his name out, and it's not looking like he can really do much still. It's year 3 for him, and
yeah,
zero development.
The other one that people talk about with movable new money contracts is Enes Kanter. We've heard that one for like a year now. The moment he signed the deal, people are like, okay, when are they going to move him? You know, and then they do the extensions with Oladipo and Adams, and like, okay, now they got to move Kanter, right? And it's like, well, they like his offense, and in a way, they sort of need it because even though Steven Adams has shown improvement offensively, he's not all the way there as like a superstar center. Like, he's just not there yet, obviously. You know, and Oladipo is not like a quintessential sidekick yet for Russell Westbrook. They don't have that rapport yet. So maybe they need to keep Kanter for another year. Or do you think a team is desperate enough that they need scoring in the middle? You know, like one of those slower teams and they feel like they need another scorer in the front court and Kanter gets taken. That's an $18 million per year contract.
Well, that's an $18 million a year, and then you could throw in a Roberson, and then bam, you have yourself a superstar thing.
Yes.
But the thing with Canada is everybody pretty much just said, that's the money you couldn't give Harden.
Mm-hmm.
That was the big one.
Let's talk really quickly about the Raptors-Kings clock gate that we had on this past Sunday, because we're sort of kind of going on short recap here because we did our show over the weekend, and this one we're doing, you know, this one we're to be totally discreet, we're doing this on a Friday. So what did you think of that whole situation with the Terrence Ross three? Our best friend Terrence Ross, who we talk about all the time, Terrence Ross made a three, but they waved it off because after review in Secaucus, which is where the office is, they always call it Secaucus. They saw that DeMarcus Cousins had tipped the ball on the inbounds, so they took away the seconds that were not rolled off before Ross had gathered the ball, and said that he would not have had enough time to make the three, which had tied the game, would have put the game in overtime, and they waved it off, and the Kings won the game. Dwayne Casey was livid. Dave Joerger was just trying to get his team off the court before they changed their mind. How did you feel about that? I mean, I felt like it was sort of a system failure.
Quick backtrack. Terrence Ross, there's also another player, perfect under the new money.
Yeah, he's like
money
at
sign.
10, or is it 9 million?
I think it's 10, but yeah. That's a very movable contract. They could upgrade with using him as a cornerstone. This is sort of one of the headaches with, you know, let's bring in replay, let's do this and that. It takes the, you know, if you're just going to have, you know, every millisecond count, it takes the human element out of the game. It's like, why don't you just have, you know, all the players wear sensors, and if, you know, the sensor gets pushed too hard, it's a foul. And it's just a little too much after the fact, like, let's change the game, not allowing a human element in.
Yeah, well, this also comes off the heels. I don't know if you heard about this one, but Michigan State played played a small school at home, and they had a bit of a controversy of their own, but theirs was a total screw-up by the referee on the court, where I didn't even realize this until it was talked about because of what happened at Michigan State, but the referees have PACs where they start the clock themselves, which I never really realized. But what happened is the referee turned on the PAC, like started the clock way earlier than he was supposed to, on an inbound where the team that was playing Michigan State was trying to get a game-winning shot. They were down 1 point. They had to do the Grant Hill Leitner pass. They were trying to do cross-court with a clean catch and a shot. Well, the referee started the clock too early on the inbounds, and they lost the second. The shot didn't go off. And they could – it was – for some reason, it was not a reviewable play. Would it have been just better off if the Raptors and the Kings had just replayed the entire possession?
Yeah, that's what you do, just replay it again. It's just, oh, well, the refs missed something, so we're going to take time off because the refs missed it. Like, if the refs make a bad call, they let it slide, but,
yeah.
Oh, you know, like, if they botch it or... this is just like, well, then what's going to stop them from having,
there is a fundamental difference, though, between the Michigan State controversy and the Raptors-Kings controversy, that Michigan State... in truest form, was human error. The referee started the clock too early. The Kings, the thing that's more alarming that, like you're talking about with the Kings-Raptors ending, is that it's a mechanical failure. It's a failure where, you know, the human error has to be judgmental. They have to have, like, even if Cousins did tip the ball, which he did, it's okay to not let the clock start immediately. You can have that half second where you don't let it go. You know, and then you get the clock rolling. In fact, if you watch the replay, Terrence Ross, as he's getting the ball, the clock already starts. So if you really wanted to say that they were able to get the shot off, you can. But what they went and did is that they looked at the letter of the law with the clock and said, no, we need to go back and start the clock to the moment it touched Cousins' fingers. And human judgment does not work that way. Like, no timekeeper and no referee with a pack is going to be able to instantly start a clock the moment a finger touches a ball with the naked eye.
Two, you know, point 2.3 seconds of just human delay of, you know, eye to brain to hand to press.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like, well, just put a sensor in the ball and have, you know, the clock run itself. And,
yeah,
you know, let's start, you know, retroactively giving fouls in the middle of breaks in halftime. So if somebody comes out, oh, now you have four fouls. You thought you had one. Now you have four. It's just let them play the game, and they shouldn't have, well, this was supposed to happen, so we're going to change the rules for this one game because something was this, as opposed to all the fouls that are missed throughout the game, all the traveling.
Part. You know, it's also the timing of it. It's like, oh, you're making a big deal out of it because it determined the outcome of a game, where it's like, well, there's a lot of missed calls, and there's a lot of times where they have to do the clock by themselves with a stopwatch because the shot clock is malfunctioning, and there's a lot of places where you could say, oh, well, we could have had a second back here, we missed a call there, and makeup calls happen all the time in the NBA and in college, but, you know, there's a lot of things that lead to that point, you know, and here's the truth about it, too. Why were the Toronto Raptors in a position where they were going to lose to the Sacramento Kings for a second time?
That's basically the argument is, you know, don't put yourself in that position. The same thing, you know.
Yeah, Jimmy Johnson told that story when they were doing that movie, when they did that ESPN 30 for 30, The U, is that they were replaying. There's a controversial ending in the Catholics versus Convicts game, which was the 1988 Miami-Notre Dame college football game, which wound up determining who was number one for the rest of the season. And what happened is Miami had their knee down the moment before a fumble when they were going in the end zone, but they called it a fumble on the field, but there was no instant replay at the time. Well, they lost the game really based on that one call. Well, they go back to Miami. They look at the film from that game. They look at that play, and Jimmy stops the play, and he thinks he's going to go off on the refs, and this is what he said. He points at it, and he says, I told all of you, don't ever put yourself in a position where they can have the benefit of a doubt. You know, basically saying, did they screw it up? Sure they did. But you messed up by getting in that position in the first place.
Exactly. There's a big difference between, you know, a close call like that where the, you know, you put the refs in, and then the blatant, what was it? It was a Seattle Seahawks game where the QB tried to sneak it in and his head wasn't even in the end zone. They gave him a touchdown.
Oh, you know, that was Vinny Testaverde back in 1998. Yeah,
there's this thing is there's a difference between a huge blatant error and then just a missed call. This, you know, it happens. You see it all the time in like college football where a team got an extra down and won the game because they had a timeout given they shouldn't have had. You can't retroactively go back, well, this should have happened. You're literally rewriting the game.
Well, here's the thing, too. All these things that where they had these waves of changes with technology and instant replay, a lot of it came on perfect storms. You know, what happened with the NFL was twice. You talk about Vinny Testaverde. That was the same year as the coin flip screw up with the Lions and the Steelers. And there was also another big time mess up that they had where they missed a call. And that's where they sort of had the outcry, you know, for bringing instant replay back into the NFL because it had been there before and they had taken it away and then they brought it back. And then the same thing happened with the replacement refs, you know, in 2012. It's like, okay, the officiating with these other refs is so bad, we've got to do something to get the regular refs back in. Major League Baseball, we had a series of incidents that happened in one game. One guy was costed a perfect game, right?
Something like that.
Where it was clear that the guy had gotten the final out, but the umpire had called him safe and he lost the perfect game. And that's where it led to the instant replay in baseball, which I've kind of got my first whiff of watching the World Series, you know, because that was the world. I'm gonna be fair. The World Series with the Cubs and the Indians, the first time I've watched Major League Baseball beginning to end in 5 years. That's the first time I've seen instant replay utilized in the way that it is in Major League Baseball. In the NBA, is there going to be a situation where like what we saw with the Raptors and Kings can become an epidemic, where something else happens where they screw up the decibels on a second, or maybe that, or something else, and it's like, okay, we need to do something to completely overhaul the system.
I hope not. It's just one of those, you know, leave it. I do like how the NBA was smart enough to let's have an off-site center where you have, you know, you have officials looking at it without crowd, you know, possible
the,
being
the
swayed.
FBC does it too. It's in Birmingham. They review the calls. They don't do it, and they don't do it in a booth.
It's nice and quick. It's not like the NFL under the hood where it's like, what are we looking at? I could see it in 5 seconds. Why are they taking a minute and a half?
Yeah, well, there's that anxiety all the time. We see it in college football a lot, especially when it's booth reviews where a play happens and you think it's kind of an easy one, and then you sort of it's almost like 12 Angry Men, where you go in thinking, oh yeah, this guy's guilty, and then it's like, okay, this one guy thinks that he's not guilty, and then the room starts to turn, and it's this process of tension. So the longer it goes, the more nervous you get, where you're like, oh, okay, this might not be like a slam dunk. And that's what happened with the Raptors-Kings, where it seemed like, oh, this is an easy review. Then it went on for like 2 or 3 minutes, and you were like, oh, okay, something's going on here, and then they waved it off.
Yeah, and it
made people very upset.
You can't just go in after the fact and try to change things, I think.
Let me ask you this about the Atlanta Hawks. We're seeing it right now with Dwight Howard. He's fit in very nicely as like their top rebounder. He is short in their rebounding big time, which was a desperate, desperate need for them. Defensively, he's fit in very nicely under Mike Budenholzer. But I have to ask you about the issues he's already had with Cody Zeller, where he was ejected for a blatant elbow, probably should have been suspended. Then he had another incident with a big man for the New York Knicks a day later. Are we sort of seeing the very beginning of Atlanta's version of the Dwight mare, which is you know what this is? It's when Dwight sort of goes in for business for himself.
Not really, because he's still going to get technicals. He's still going to play hard because, you know, he's been doing it for.
But Adam, these are the flagrants and technicals that gather up and kill you in May and June.
But they're going to add up. But at the same time, you know, he's not going to not play hard and not get them. That's the same way, you know, Cousins can get them. Usually the center is the one who pick up the most technicals, usually just from playing hard and having to rebound. I don't think it's the beginning of the end, because he's much more, you know, he's lasted much longer now and more disciplined as opposed to, you know, what he used to be.
Yeah, we don't know what's going on in the locker room, but we haven't heard too many rumblings of, well, Dwight wants the ball. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, the first year that Houston had Dwight Howard, they were over the moon because they felt like they stole him. You know, Daryl Morey did. And then,
Harden sort of.
Well, what happened is Dwight had the knee injury. He was out for the majority of the regular season.
Knee injury and the back injury.
Exactly. Harden took over, and then when Dwight came back in, it was like, oh, it's not my team anymore. It's Harden's team. And then jealousy kicked in.
Not to just sidetrack you for a minute, but can I just say Hawks lost 3 of their last 4. The only team they beat was the Pacers. And from your last week's, are they the number 2 team? I said no, they had an easy schedule.
I kind of remember that.
Yeah, they losing
but,
to your
but,
Pelicans.
I mean, but, well, look at the Raptors losing that game against the Kings, getting blasted by the Warriors and the Cavs like we talked about in the previous episode. I mean, they have their own concerns. Now, they did bounce back big time against the Rockets.
They got a brutal schedule there. Didn't they play the Clippers, the Warriors?
They did. I believe they played the Clippers in L.A., if I stand correct.
Clippers in L.A., the Warriors and Cleveland, 3 out of 4. That's just shell shocked. They had no chance with that.
DeRozan's average has dropped out of first, which doesn't mean he's playing exactly. It doesn't mean he's in a slump at all. He's only, quote-unquote, at 30 points a game. Now, the guys that I believe have jumped him so far is Russell Westbrook, and I want to say it's Anthony Davis. I think that James Harden is right there somewhere, but I don't want to. I'm pretty sure all 4 of the guys I just mentioned, DeRozan, Harden, Westbrook, and Davis, are all at over 30 points a game. Westbrook, I believe, is first at 30. I want to say 31.
I believe he is. The only things I know regarding that is Westbrook and Harden lead the leagues in turnovers by over 1. I think Wall is 3rd.
And Harden, I believe, is – he's not first in assists, but he's right there. Speaking of assists, I got to talk about LeBron James, who right now is like 3rd in the league in assists. League MVP, I'm going to tell you the truth, and I know it's super competitive already going into the first month of the season. I think LeBron James is the MVP, and it's not even close.
Yeah.
I mean,
so far. Well,
would you,
what happened?
Would you argue the not even close part?
Well, what about your boy AD?
The team's not good enough. This is not Major League Baseball where Andre Dawson won MVP and his team was last. Like, it's just not going to happen. You know, I mean, LeBron is at, you know, he's at 23 points a game, 23.8, which is decent. And then at the rebound mark, I believe he's at 9 or he's at 8.5. And then at assists, he's at 9.3. The only guys who have more assists per game than him are Westbrook and Harden. Harden will not get more than 10 rebounds a game, or I don't even think he'll reach 8. Or, I mean, or is he close to that?
He's close, but I think it's Harden. Right now LeBron is, but Westbrook and Harden will definitely...
Here's the irony of it, is that everyone's already manufacturing the story of, well, Westbrook's going to try to average a triple-double, and you know, Harden is chasing it with all the assists, and if he picks up his rebounds, maybe he has... LeBron was the original, he might average a triple-double guy. Like, he was the new version of Oscar Robertson, and people almost kind of forgot about it, and he has just stealthily put out incredibly efficient numbers. You know, the fact that he had, like, 12 assists for Kevin Love in, like, I think, like, the first half, you know, that was just a sign of, like, man, LeBron's just a lot smarter than a lot of these other players, you know?
Yeah, but at the same time, you can't give, you know, at that point, you know, under that logic, the Cavaliers and the Warriors are going to win all the awards because they're the best teams. Yeah, LeBron's having, you know, an awesome month, but there's, you know, he's going to be getting rest and he's going to have his minutes cut. And that, like I said, there's no reason I don't think Westbrook isn't going to, you know, wrap this up eventually.
Think it's going to be one of those MJ 1988 MVPs where it's like, okay, his team's not the best, but his numbers are just way too good to overlook them.
Yeah, like Westbrook's playing with the vengeance factor. Harden's just playing with the "it's me, I'm James Harden" factor. And LeBron's, you know, LeBron's smart, and he's also, you know, he lost Dellavedova, who gave, you know, decent numbers. And there's no substitution for that. So LeBron's, the thing is, if you notice, LeBron's been playing. He's top 10 in minutes right now. So
yeah, he's really chalking it up lately.
That's
now,
not going to continue.
He did rest against the Pacers, you know, on the second night of a back-to-back about, I think it was about a week ago, maybe over a week ago. The other one who's played very well is Chris Paul. But the other thing is that Blake Griffin has played great as well. So there's a theory there that they might split the votes between each other. You know, who the top player in L.A. is.
Yeah, then, you know, so under that theory, well, who's to say Kyrie or Kevin Love can't step up and take some votes away from him?
I'm glad you mentioned Kevin Love. When Klay Thompson got the 37-point quarter against the Kings, if you watch the montage of it, it's really Klay just going off by himself, because that's the kind of player Klay Thompson is. He's one of those guys, he can just kind of create his own offense right off of a dime. He gets in a standstill with that perfect form, starts drilling threes, starts taking it to the rack on layups with that kind of herky-jerky motion. He's just one of those incredibly blessed offensive players. Kevin Love's a blessed offensive player too. He had 34 points in the first quarter against the Portland Trail Blazers. How much credit... Like, look, what I'm trying to get at is that not a lot of credit was given to others for Klay Thompson's performance. It's sort of isolated as Klay Thompson was amazing for one quarter. How much credit do you give to LeBron and Kyrie for Kevin Love's historic first quarter?
Oh, I don't know. That's I would say more than you'd give Klay Thompson, because Klay Thompson is just a shooter. He doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, he's, I don't want to say he's a specialist, but Kevin Love, you know, it all started with that crazy, it was like a fadeaway. It was a very hard shot
in
his first
one. He had four threes in the first 3 minutes, I believe, or first 4 minutes. You know, it was very early on. You were just like, uh-oh, like he's hot, you know, and LeBron knew it. He's like, okay, I'm dishing it off to him. I think he had 8 assists.
Something like that. And
it's in the first quarter.
Yeah, it's just smart players knowing you're the
plays.
Yeah, you know where the hot hand is and you run it and you go with it, and it's just smart. It's the team mentality of, we're going to go with whoever's hot. We don't care if you're the guy, you're the guy.
I saw this with Kyrie Irving. Didn't he have the 57-point quarter? Or quarter, oh my God. 57-point game against the Spurs, who was like the best defensive team in the league at the time.
Well, don't forget, Kyrie went off on the Spurs, yes, but how come teams that are terribly defensively somehow shut people down? It's just if you get hot, it doesn't matter who you're facing. You could be facing the best team in the world. If you're hot, you're gonna hit, 7 out of 8 from three. So it doesn't matter who you're against. It's just if the entire team is hot, that's one thing. It's like, oh my God, people shot 60% against the Spurs. Okay, that I might be a little odd, but one player going off, that's just one player.
And the other, the underrated element is to speak again, to speak of the team of which it happens against. So the Blazers, like, concerned yet?
No.
Even though Evan Turner is just absolute garbage efficiency wise right now.
He just doesn't really fit in that system, and it's just, Boston was hurting without him now because
Their
he.
bench is terrible scoring wise.
Yeah, and it's just, well, you have the team. The team is just McCollum and Lillard, and if it's not those, you were meant to be a defensive special because that's what Harkless and Aminu are. So if you can't really bring in this sort of mid-range shooter who doesn't fit anything, and it's just sort of one of those, they're still trying to figure out where everybody fits, and him and Crabbe, well, they have to sort of play the second
Yeah.
unit together, and they're.
And McCollum and Lillard are fresh enough that they can handle that load without wearing down. I mean, by the way, did you like Lillard's circus shot against the Nets? Is
Yep.
that somewhere in your pantheon there?
Nope, that was just a good shot.
It reminded me of the. Remember when Brook Lopez had that one last season? I can't remember. Do you remember the one I'm talking about where he was falling down and he just kind of like curveballed it in?
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me, which is ironic because it was against the Nets that he did it. All right, I think that's going to kind of do it for this show. It was funny because me and Adam were talking about it at the beginning. I was like, this is kind of a slow week. We didn't really have much to say, and here we go talking about pretty much everything. Anything you want to talk about before we get out of here?
No, happy shopping. We'll be off next week. We'll be back in mid-December to see where everything is.
Yeah, we actually have to wait to play a few more games, as we get towards Christmas, because Christmas is kind of like the real start of the regular season. I mean, it's not like the first 2 months are unimportant because they are for standings, but like it's really after Christmas to me where things really get going.
The first 2 months, like we said, is with seeing what your players can do, seeing what combinations work, finding your rotation, finding your minutes, finding who complements each other.
Yes. And also whatever Christmas jerseys they come out with this year, so it'll be fun. All right, on behalf of Adam Murray, this is Andrew.